I'm Christina Onnestad reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you are tuned into WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features Katrina's impact 20 years on. Africa Now is next. Welcome to Shaw Mwiza Muntali. The music in the background is Blue Nile by Alice Coltrane, and we play that commemorating her birthday, which is August 27. First, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you for supporting Africa Now and WPFW during our recently concluded summer pledge drive. We really value and treasure your support at this critical time. Thank you for ensuring that WPFW is not erased and that it continues to be a platform for the community which builds a better world one broadcast at a time. August 29 will mark 20 years since Hurricane Katrina made landfall on New Orleans, Louisiana. Most of the city was flooded, leaving many homeless. Hurricane Katrina caused the death of nearly 1,400 people along the Gulf of Mexico. The damages incurred by Hurricane Katrina made it the costliest Atlantic hurricane. Katrina was also the fourth most intense Atlantic hurricane. Today we'll focus on the impact of Katrina on New Orleans and beyond. Particular attention will be on the disproportional negative impact of climate change on people of the African world, climate justice, environmental destruction by multinational corporations, and the role of a Pan-Africanist environmental movement. Joining the show in this discussion is Reverend Lennox Yearwood, president of the Hip Hop Caucus, which is an organization that mobilizes and organizes communities of color to fight for racial, climate, and economic justice. Reverend Lennox Yearwood is also host and producer of Climate Friday on WPFW every Friday. Here is my conversation, which I had with Reverend Yearwood yesterday. Reverend Yearwood, welcome to the show.
It is so good to be with you. Always good to hear your voice.
Oh, it's great to hear you all the time. I listen to you as one of those must-listen-to shows on WPFW on Climate Friday.
Yes, and, on Friday, 9 o'clock. Yes, 9 indeed.
O'clock every day. Yeah, and we're here to talk about looking at Katrina 20 years on, and some of the issues that have it had raised, as well as some of the things happening after what people are doing. But I first wanted to touch base on you, because this is not just a story from afar. You're from Louisiana.
I am.
From Freeport. I wanted you to just talk to us about the community pre-Katrina. How was the situation in Louisiana, particularly in New Orleans and et cetera?
Louisiana is like many places in the South of America, in which the people there have figure out a way to survive in spite of. And so there is joy. There's a sense of belonging. There's power. There's our own culture. There's our own music. There's our own way of living. And we've done that sometimes to survive, simply to survive. And so Louisiana, like many of the Southern states, really any place in America where Black people have lived, they've lived within a place where it is still sometimes very racist and very controlling of one's movement. And so Louisiana is a place where before Katrina, you definitely had all of the joy. We have a number of Black colleges. My parents, who originally came to this country, they both came here from Trinidad to go to school. Hence how I was born in Louisiana and then lived there. But in that, they came and their culture was adaptable because of the music. The flavor. So before Katrina, there's joy, and after Katrina, there's joy. And we'll be very clear. After Katrina, people are still very strong. That's actually one of the most important things about Katrina, is that despite the storm, despite how much things were used against the people to cut them off, to send them afar, that we still survived. So while we will gather on the 29th and cry about those we lost, we will also look about what we need to do to continue to fight for liberation as particularly as Black people.
Yeah. And also you mentioned that your family coming from Trinidad and Tobago, that there's that the adaptation, that being an island nation, and also where people of African descent are. Of course, Louisiana has, historically was before the U.S. Took it over. It was actually sold from France. So there's that, all these connections, interconnections, which have with the Caribbean.
That's right.
With the Caribbean, and Haiti being the big connection.
There's a very strong Haitian, obviously, people who have come down here. There's a very strong Haitian, not just from the culture, but from the people within New Orleans and Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Haiti is, you know, the earthquake that happened in 2010 as well, which devastated the country as well. And so there's all these similarities and connections and with it, in terms of the climate issues as well, not just culture, but also in the people, but that connection. And you, as you were saying, the strength of what has happened within the community that has been there, the foundation. If you could expand a bit, because I was reading somewhere where some people were talking about this was a series which was called the Katrina Babies. Mm-hmm. And talking about how I just saw something where one of the persons in that segment was saying how he had lost so many of the people that were actually helping mold him within that structure, within the community, which something is we don't get to hear enough of the mentoring that was taking place block by block, section by section.
Yeah, that's actually very important. It's one of the, as we are gathering here for the 20th commemoration of Hurricane Katrina, one of the key issues is around mental health and around community. And it's around that one of the things that we lost a lot of the wisdom and the leadership and a lot of the community within the storm. One of the folks who stayed behind to help our community and on the 7th Ward on Dergeron Street was a beautiful woman named Mama D. Mama D, real name is Diane French Cole, but we know it's Mama D. And Mama D was the first Black woman to lead the NAACP chapter in New Orleans. Beautiful woman, small in stature, but had these amazing long gray dreadlocks. And she stayed behind knowing just the history of who was in her community. In other words, her community was a community built primarily with Black people, and they had become seniors, but they were the ones who were the last hired in the first fire, the ones who rode in the back of the bus, those mostly in around the 80s and 90s. And when the storm hit, a lot of them could not evacuate. And that was probably because of the poor preparedness of the community and leadership at that time. And what had happened is that a lot of these seniors begin to lose their lives because of the flood. And some of them begin to float down the street. And Mama D would run out there and catch them and as they were floating down the street and tie them to the tree in front of her house. And when people ask them, Mama D, why did you do it? You risked your life. Why did you do that? And she said, for these seniors. And she said, primarily because that was our legacy. And those were my neighbors. And so you're right. There was so much. And many of those, for young people, they lost that. And so we, that is one of the things that we are overcoming. And we see that in many communities, not just by the natural, but even by the unnatural storms that come through communities around the globe, that we're losing that connection to our wisdom. And it's, and it has a huge impact on our young people.
Yeah. And it's, especially as they try to meander through this very complicated system that they have to confront in this
most definitely
this country system, which doesn't give you any support in any way, and especially as we're dealing with it now, where it's a subtle and not so subtle ways of demeaning people and disempowering people,
and that's intentional, as we know. Yeah. We know that's intentional. Yeah. That's a way of we know one thing about, like, Hurricane Katrina. It wasn't just a crisis. It was also a mirror, and it also mirrored everything that this country is. So it's white supremacy, it's racism, it's greed, it's capitalism. And so it was a mirror of that. And so I think that what we see, ironically, is a lot of these and a lot of disasters that are connected to the climate crisis, the droughts, the wildfires, the hurricanes, the floods, they are a mirror to what is happening as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm glad you said the mirror, because as we go back, going back to Haiti again, as we connect into Haiti and Louisiana a connection, the earthquake that happened in 2010, a lot of the reasons why there was so much damage and for people, the fatalities, was really human-made because of the way the U.S. had disempowered that country historically, and also in present day situation where the U.S. had blocked funding for critical needs of the institutional building of that country, which has devastated the country to be able to deal with such emergencies. And again, we're talking in Louisiana, similar situations as well, where we have certain areas which are devastated, impacted, unfortunate areas which have disproportionately the largest community of African descent as well. So we see these, as you deal with climate issues constantly, particularly on your show, Climate Friday on WPFW and beyond, climate change and that we're facing, and particularly as in the context of Katrina, it's more of a man-made situation.
Oh, without a doubt. That is, well, the one thing we know in Louisiana that we are dealing with. So I was born in Shreveport, Louisiana, and that would be considered right outside what is called Cancer Alley, which is an 85-mile stretch of land between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. And we know in that particular area, this is way before they had a lot of these chemicals. They put the petrochemical facilities and landfills within these communities because it's around predominantly Black people. But those are the same things that are causing the pollution that's causing the climate crisis. We saw this within Inconvenient Truth. When that documentary came out, we realized that the Inconvenient Truth just wasn't the climate crisis, but it was also white supremacy. So I think you're right. The link there is that there's a strong link between the destruction that is being caused, the greed of corporations. We know that their business plan means a death sentence for our communities. That greed has a direct impact on our communities, not only within Louisiana, but all around the globe. And that's a unique dynamic because of the climate crisis, because it is a global crisis. It is also a global connection, which is why we need to have a strong Pan-African mindset around dealing with the climate crisis, because the same issues that are happening within folks who are both from the problem and solution, those who are trying to find a solution within EVs, which is affecting the Congo, or those who are trying to find solutions that are impacting those on from the Fijis to Hawaii with solar and wind. But those same situations are also being put forth by an extractive mentality. But we need a solution, that's clear. But how we do that and how we utilize that of our people and most vulnerable is the issue that we must address.
Again, that's Reverend Lennox Yearwood. He's the president and CEO of Hip Hop Caucus. And if his voice is familiar for you listening on WPFW, he is also host and producer of Climate Friday on WPFW every Friday. And we're looking at the impact 20 years on. And as you said, this is very much a Pan-Africanist struggle, just as the struggle for freedom was a Pan-Africanist movement as well. When the people,
most definitely.
Yeah, so they, all those folks who were meeting in the 1800s, late 1800s and 1900s were, you know, they're all from all over. Do you see that there's a need for something like that right now? More intentional. I mean, people say it, but more intentional, just as there was that call to action politically for political freedom as well as human rights back in the day, and really being more intentional about adding climate as a Pan-Africanist struggle.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. It is probably the most connecting before being obviously being a Pan-Africanist is connected to white supremacy and racism and colonizing all over the globe. Those are the exact same traits that are causing the climate crisis. It is ditto across the line. So the same thing that was utilized to broaden a powerful Pan-African movement in the 20th century must be still instilled in the 21st century. And on top of that, what's different, though, is that in the 20th century, the issue was primarily around equality. In the 21st century, with the climate crisis, it's still equality, but it's also existence. We're dealing with something where you're also just wiping out communities because of the drought, because of the floods in certain communities, because of the lack of food and food scarcity, because of the hurricanes and the wildfires, and those who are worse than first impacted by this. It's our communities, Black, Brown, Indigenous people on the globe. That is why we must have a strong Pan-African mentality to address the climate crisis that we are in right now and moving forward, because it is not just about equality. It is about existence.
Yeah, the word to use, the existence, is really powerful. And when you talk about existence, one of the things that also that comes to mind is the lack of understanding of how our people that came before us were able to use the environment for making sure that they are good stewards of the earth. Since you're a clergy person, you understand that aspect as well. And do you see that also? That's something that we can bring back to the table, and especially as dealing with Pan-Africans, looking at how people back in the day were very much aware of their environmental role in the world, making sure good.
No, of course. I mean, one of the key words and the slogan, so to speak, during the movement was free to land. There was a direct connection of understanding what that meant. And one, just the understanding that you had to, those who were in control of the land were those who were in control of the people. And so there was just an understanding of your environment, just the overall environment of what you were living in. And so I think there must be a connection to that. And then the health, how healthy your environment is. I mean, obviously, if the water is toxic and the air is toxic, then the life expectancy and livelihood of the people who were fighting for, at the core of Pan-Africanism, is love. That's the core. The core of it is a love for your community, a love for your people. So at the core of that, it is wanting to see your people to do well. That is the reason why you are connecting the dots between and around the globe. So I think that, no, there is no doubt. I would say there's certain things that we learn from our our ancestors and those who came before us, we want to avoid the vestiges of how easy it is to slide into capitalism. We know there were many countries, particularly in Africa and around the globe, but who had leaders who were amazing leaders who fought for liberation. And then when they got into power, it began to get a little shaky in that aspect. So I think the same thing here, as we are dealing with a new 21st century type of movement that is dealing with how we are engaging with resources and production and power. You mentioned even Katrina babies. We're now utilizing media differently, obviously with social media. So I think that as we are dealing with a new way in the 21st century of how we're engaging things, when we get into the power of these things, we want to make sure that we don't lose ourselves, that we don't allow even those who are progressive, we don't want to allow for the nonprofit industrial complex to taint and to shame our goals around these things. And so I think there's a lot of things we can also learn that came before us that we can utilize now in this 21st century movement for liberation for our people to be not to, to have long lives at this time.
And is that something that the people now, as part of your work in Katrina, as they're trying to rebuild both physically, mentally, and otherwise, are doing, going back to some of those lessons that they lost before?
Yes, I think that one of the things we still need a federal emergency management agency, FEMA. We need that. And that was, it's still very important for our tax dollars, the money that people put into something to then help them in times of need. That's without a doubt. But we also realized that we need a PEMA, which is a people's emergency management agency, where we take care of one another. So I think that one of the things that we've learned from Katrina is that while we can rely on the FEMA, we need a PEMA. We need to have structures and systems that allow for us, our mosques, our churches, our community centers, those things that we have in our institutions, that they could be utilized in times of crisis and destruction. We also realize that education is very important. I think that I'm so proud of all the documentaries. You mentioned Katrina Babies. There's documentaries that are coming out now on Netflix. Katrina, Come Hell and High Water, the one recently done by Ryan Coogler and his wife Zinzi, that's out there now. I think that the educational aspect of this, and also retelling the story the correct way, is very important. And I think also building resources. I think that many times a lot of particularly white progressives came into New Orleans and try to, you know, use that as a playground to build homes and that weren't suited for the environment. I think that we have to still have our engineers, our electricians, our builders, our folks in our community who can come into and build the community, the housing and the structures, and build it with green space and community gardens. All those things are very important as we are now rebuilding. I think we can rebuild also after the storm. And I think that's one of the things that we are doing in New Orleans and throughout Louisiana.
And as you said, rebuilding, it actually reminds me of how are you going to connect with beyond the people in Louisiana with the other water communities worldwide, particularly I'm thinking of the folks who are in Nigeria, some of the people they live on, and they use water like water. They live in the water. I mean, they basically live on the water, but they're using it in a very environmentally friendly way, not the same type of material. How are people trying to connect with our architects and other professions from like communities so that they can produce communities which are more environmentally friendly?
Yeah, I think this is one of the great feathers in the cap for what the United Nations is doing in regards to holding different conferences and places of gathering on international level. The climate conference of the parties, which is called COP, is held each year. It'll be held in Brazil this year. We also have different UN conferences that are bringing us together to discuss these things so we can have multi-international conversations. I just came back before coming back to Louisiana for Katrina 20. I was in Geneva for a UN's conference and was talking with many of those who were coming from the continent, particularly around the issue of not rebuilding per se, but around the issues of plastic. One of the things that is happening around the globe is this amazing dependence on plastic. And we're seeing plastic in the water, in the rivers around the globe. We're seeing plastic in our bodies. We are now, as human beings, we are now consuming a credit card size worth of plastic through microfibers in our bodies each and every week. And now men are seeing that in their testicles. Women are seeing that in the placenta. We have babies that are being born with plastic in their brain. And so we are having these conversations and obviously in our water supply. And so we're having, and obviously plastics are fossil fuel. Coming from oil and gas. And so we're having these conversations about what we can do about that. But we're also having the other conversations about how we can trade knowledge and information so that as we are dealing with the fact of climate, the climate crisis, how do we then live in a world that technically won't go back? And so how do we live in this world? And I think we're trading ways to be more resilient and having those conversations as well.
And as you're having those conversations, do you see that some of those meetings at the COP, which are, the next one coming up is COP 29, is it 28?
COP 30 in Brazil.
30 in Brazil. And do you see that also as a great place for activists such as yourself, beyond the official delegations who are muddled with a lot of political intrigue and things like that? Do you see that also as a place where you're having activists from all sides being able to connect to really push for change?
Oh, most definitely. It's a place, and that's an excellent question, because it's a place because we need, in this time, obviously, the U.S. government and other governments like it are behaving badly in regards to how they're utilizing these conferences. They actually, at the one in Geneva, they are siding with corporations to continue to pollute communities globally. And so it is critical for activists and civil society to be at these places and in these conversations, either in the room or outside. And I think that it also helps us to connect the dots so that when we're coming there and we're coming from Bolivia or coming there from South Africa, we're coming there from Jamaica, wherever we're coming from, Barbados, coming right from Turtle Island here in America, then we're coming to a place where we could also then connect the dots. We can see, okay, hold on, these corporations that are doing this damage are doing it not just in our own community, not only in Oakland, but they're doing it in Nigeria, doing it globally. And so we're connecting the dots. I would 100% think that it's important for civil society and NGOs and to be participating in these conversations and showing up. Also, again, a lot of young people who may not understand the tenets or the understanding the fabric of what it means to be Pan-African at this time or in the past, we need them to even just have opportunities to have conversations as we're gathering globally. We need to just have conversations about what it means to connect the dots, what it means to understand everything runs through Africa. And so how do we then have a conversation, a climate conversation, knowing that if Africa is weak, then the world will be weak. And so how do we then have these conversations, particularly from those who are a lot of European countries, to understand the importance of this on a global scale?
You're listening to a recent conversation with Reverend Lennox Yearwood, President and CEO of Hip Hop Caucus, and he's also host and producer of Climate Friday on WPFW every Friday. The conversation looks at Katrina's impact 20 years on. As you're aware, August 29th will mark 20 years since Hurricane Katrina made landfall on New Orleans, Louisiana. The music in the background is Kurima by Chinoisa Marere. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW, 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation. Yeah, and also on the understanding the impact of the shrinking of the coastlines, for instance, right. Which is very much happening in the Gulf of Mexico, and as well as in West Africa, along the coast. That's why you're seeing a lot of flooding in Ghana and other places. Yeah, and but if we, going back to New Orleans specifically. Could you I remember when I was in high school, this takes me back, long story short, when I was in high school in Ghana, studying the geography of that area. And what I was struck by, I was so shocked that I'd already lived here in the United States, but it took me to live in Ghana to understand that New Orleans was not on the coast. Most people don't realize New Orleans is not on the coast.
No.
It's actually a few miles, it's like 80 some miles from the coast.
Not 80, but it's not on the coast on the Gulf, but it definitely has the waterways that go through it.
Yeah,
but
And so that again also kind of tells you the importance of really understanding devastating impact of it, because if that far out, that far from the, it's not like on the ghost, it's not like Galveston or something like right on the
no
coast.
And in Louisiana, we're losing through our wetlands, we're losing about a football field or more every single day of our coastline. So it's just being eroded away by climate change. And so you're right. And then that is that was the natural defense that is gone.
Yeah. And I think that's something that also we probably should emphasize a bit more so that people understand how important it is. If Louisiana, if New Orleans, yes, because it has the Mississippi Delta and all that, but still it's not like right on the coast and it's still impacted like that. Can you imagine the towns which are directly on the coast, towns like Accra, Ghana, or places, Lagos, Nigeria, and other
New York City,
yes, right, New York City, right. So that as we're talking about this, the lessons from from Katrina, has there been movement now to trying to make sure the wetlands are more protected than before, and also trying to make sure that as you mentioned, the multinational corporations which are putting up all sorts of oil storage areas around that area and things like that.
This is the sad part from a human standpoint, that these corporations clearly understand if they begin to admit to the climate crisis, then people will then say, well, then you are the institutions and entities that are causing it, and it will hurt their bottom line. And so they're just putting on the blinders and acting like there is no problem. And they're doing everything to stop that. So legislation and policy, they're trying with anything that could be done to help that. They're trying to stop that because, again, if you acknowledge the problem, then you'll look for what is causing the problem. And so they're trying everything they can. So while the coastline wastes away by our natural ability to protect ourselves wastes away, they're doing that because they don't want anyone to then see that they're also the reason why that is happening. And so we're in a conundrum. We're seeing that particularly here in the United States, we're seeing it on the federal level. We're seeing that people at the highest level saying, knowing the impacts of the fossil fuel on our climate and on our environment, saying drill, baby, drill. It is a suicidal mentality. It is truly a titanic level. And when people are going forward, they're cutting away from the solutions and going to the problem just for their own greed. And unfortunately, that will have a huge impact on future generations, that we now are at a point where babies that are being born this year in 2025 should have a good chance of living 75 years, which means that they will possibly see the 2100. We now have children and babies that are being born that will see 2101. That this is where we're now ushering into a new generation. And unfortunately, what will be left for them could be disastrous. And the fact that they're not going to care about who was in charge, they're only going to care that did the people alive during this time, did they fight like they could fight no other to have clean air and clean water and fight for the environment? Or are we all now just walking around with oxygen tanks on our banks, on our backs? Are we living in a place where it is a ghost town? Are we at constant war for resources because they did not have the power to stand up to these corporations and to do what they were doing? And I say, we have to stand up. We got to fight. We got to make sure that we are saying enough is enough, that we have to do, if nothing else, for the next generation that when we're gone. And that also is a part of being a good ancestor. And I think our job is to be a good ancestor in a position where we're taking on and at least fighting so they have clean air and clean water.
Mm. And as I said, the corporations are fighting tooth and nail not to work on tooth the solution.
They're fighting everything they can to stop that. And it is now one of the saddest stories for humanity. If humanity goes down, it will go down because these entities have finally figured out a code to destroy humanity. And it's so sad.
And again, that's Reverend Lennox Yearwood. He is the president and CEO of Hip Hop Caucus. And we're looking at Katrina, the impact of Katrina, Hurricane Katrina, 20 years later. And Reverend Yearwood is also host and producer of Climate Friday on WPFW. As you're talking about the corporations, one cannot divorce the corporations and government, the power of the lobbyists of corporations. Because when we go back to Katrina, George Bush was the president then in 2005. And at that time, he was also trying to scale down the Federal Emergency Management Agency, known as FEMA. And we're seeing the same situation today. If you could talk a little bit more about the impact of corporations in that aspect as well, because you have all the corporations who are lobbyists all in D.C. have a heavy, heavy control over what government does.
Without a doubt. Well, I think that's where we are. Where is the issue where they are putting profits before people, and they are putting pollution before people. And so I just want to say, I mentioned earlier about the United Nations. These corporations are sending the most. As I said, we have to send civil society and activists because these corporations they're sending their people to these UN negotiations. So we actually saw, in the last COP that there were more people who were from corporations, showing up as delegates or showing up to the COP than they were actually people from the countries. And so that just shows you how they're flooding, our democracy, but our systems of power. And we're seeing that obviously within here. We're seeing that in America, but we're also seeing that across the globe. We're very, very clear that the fossil fuel industry is flooding, in many cases, the system of power in Africa, in the Caribbean, in South America, in the global South. They're doing it as well. They're not just, and that's why we'd be very careful, because a lot of times now we're seeing people who look like us and sound like us, but they've already sided with the fossil fuel industry. And they say everybody who's your skin folk ain't your kinfolk. And so I think we'd be very careful now about that, about who is in power, because who was funding these entities? A lot of them are being funded, and which is why I love WPFW, because I get to make sure support our station, because it's funded by the people. But it is a situation there where a lot of these entities are funding. So we're seeing people coming out of the continent, or seeing come out of the Caribbean and other, or out of the global South. And they are literally look like us. They come from our communities, but they are lockstep in line with these entities that are killing our people. And so I think we'd just be very careful about that. And I think, and that's something that we have to just make sure we're looking at the principles. What are you standing for? Are you for the community? Are you for our existence? Are you for our sovereignty? Are you for our liberation? And I think we have to ask these questions of all of us, better who they look like when they're coming to us.
It's the neocolonialism of environmentalism. As you said, we have to be careful. Like, we have to look at the principles, the fine print. And we talked about the COP last time and how the number of delegates from the corporations really trying to hijack that whole movement and or slow it down to make sure that they don't have to do the heavy lifting to really have a positive change. But as you're talking, you had also mentioned earlier on about having a people-centered a PEMA, right? Instead of a FEMA, a people's,
that's right. Yeah, people's emergency management agency. We need a PEMA to take PEMA. Yes.
And now, in terms of having a PEMA, what are some of the things that have taken place in Katrina? Because I can see people, as you said, people in New Orleans when Katrina happened, they're very resilient and they've always had to really fend for themselves because the system is not going to help them as much. What are some of the things that they've done on the local level to have this realization of a PEMA?
Yeah, so a number of things. I mean, I think there's two parts to that. We mentioned earlier about understanding the heart and the history of New Orleans and weather. So obviously we're doing things that allow for us to deal with if other hurricanes or other disasters come to the city, how we're now dealing with evacuations for ourselves, not waiting on the city, not waiting to be ushered into the Superdome, or to be left behind after the storm has subsided. So where the systems are being put in place here in the city with officials on local level to ensure that people can not be left behind again. And so that's one of the most important things that's there. I think that there has been a number of educational aspects of being radically hopeful about how we can turn trial to testimony. And I think that we've done that with even little things, the levees that were kind of an opaque, kind of white. We had young people who we gave summer jobs to, who painted what they believe a future looks like on the levees. So that's little things like that. On top of that, we've actually worked with the city officials in New Orleans. So for the first time ever for a natural disaster, there would be a city holiday in Louisiana, in New Orleans. The city would be closed on Friday, August 29th, as well as we put in the work to have a state holiday. And that's one of the first times we've had, even in this state, which has been very partisan, we've had post-partisan, I would say, efforts around that, and non-partisan efforts around that, to make it a state holiday, August 29th. And so I think that on that level, we've been trying to shape policy. We're not stopping there. We're working to stop the petrochemical aspects that are in Louisiana that are causing the climate crisis, and doing everything we can to protect and transition from what people have called Cancer Alley to Solutions Alley, finding out different ways to bring in different, that don't bring in things that are killing us like fossil fuels, but how do we bring in maybe like things from the media and doing movies, as we have very good tax brackets in Louisiana to bring in. We saw that with the movie Sinners that was made here, other movies that are coming here. And I think that one of the things there that we're doing is that we're trying to take care of one another. As you mentioned earlier about Katrina babies, there's a lot of young people who are hurting, who are self-medicating. And so we're trying to create summer programs and activities that allow for them to work through the pain of having lost their grandmother, having lost their mother, lost family members in Katrina, not having those roots around them. So we're doing a lot in our communities. And then finally, I would say that one of the things, Maggie Baird, who's the mother of Billie Eilish, has a group called Support and Feed. And we've been working on doing food scarcity in the community about making sure we have good food and also making sure people can get to food in the community. So a lot is being done. And I think that here in New Orleans, but most important, I think, is just the standpoint that people can see that after 20 years that we're still here. We're mm-hmm. still here and we're still fighting. And I think that I'm so glad here on WPFW, actually, we're going to have a whole this Friday. We'll have from the Ninth Ward to the Airways, which will commemorate the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. And they can listen to that all on Friday from 9 to 7 p.m. And so it'll be very powerful. If anybody want to hear more from the people themselves, you'll hear that on Friday here on WPFW.
And that's Friday, August 29th on WPFW. And as you can listen to it far and wide and on WPFWFM.org. That's from nine all day, right?
All 9 o'clock. All day from nine to seven. It'll be a 12-hour programming on the 20 years after Katrina.
Yeah, and before we go, I wanted to also get what the demands of the people are, because when there was a rebuilding, and also rebuilding not just of the physical structures, but also like the education systems and things, the lower ninth ward, which has always been neglected, if I'm correct in saying that, but has that been given especially more attention this time around, or are we seeing more of the same?
I would say, so part of the demands is still to rebuild. There is no doubt that, well, part of the demands is obviously to honor the victims and survivors of Hurricane Katrina and to advocate for policies that protect and uplift New Orleans and Gulf South communities. And one of the things there is to rebuild and to continue to rebuild in a way that allows for the people who are in New Orleans, but also around the world to see that we can rebuild in a way that uplifts the spirit and the dignity of the people who were there before and will be there long after. And I think that's one of the things that we understand, that we must shape policy to do this, because either you shape policy or policy shapes you. So we're working through policy lenses to do that. But I would say the most important thing is, and if you tune in on Friday, you'll listen, but it's the spirit. And I would say this to everyone, wherever you are, if you're on the continent, the Caribbean, I don't care. But just know, don't let anybody steal your joy or your love or your spirit. And I think the one thing about New Orleans that is clear, that was not broken. The spirit of the people was not broken. And so the one thing we want people to know is that our spirit was not broken. Our resolve was not broken. Our power was not broken. And we are still here.
And has there been any more, has the efforts from governments been supporting the areas that were more impacted, or has it been what's the report card on that, of the areas which have been constantly been impacted by the environmental issues that we talked about, the pollution and also the...
That is the fight. Moving forward, the fight moving forward post Katrina 20 is the environmental fight. It is the fight where they, in many cases, try to use disaster, as Naomi Klein in her great book talks about. People use disaster to benefit for themselves. They have definitely tried to do that in some aspects. But I would say that the key thing now that they are trying to use and trying to continue to put pollution into the air. This is why the issue of petrochemicals is so important for what we're doing. In our press conference on Monday, we talked about that, what we need for them to stop, manufacturing the petrochemicals that are being utilized to pollute not only our local communities, but the world. So I think that's the next step. And I would also encourage people, if you want to find more information about what we're doing, you can just go to Katrina20.com. That's Katrina20.com, with more information. And also, there'd be a moment of silence, because you mentioned, as we are rebuilding, it has been very difficult. In many cases, people have died not only from the storm, but from broken hearts. And so on Friday, there'll be a national moment of silence. So wherever you are in the world, listen to this at 11:20. We'll be doing it at 11:20 Central Time, but wherever you are, 11:20 your time, we ask you to pause for 60 seconds to honor the lives and forever the lives lost and forever changed by Katrina. And that includes you, as many of us saw this. We saw around the globe, people watched that, and they saw that all over the world. And it became not only a national, but international issue, event.
Reverend Yearwood, thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be with us.
Thank you so much.
Yes, we listened to a conversation with Reverend Lennox Yearwood, president of the Hip Hop Caucus. Reverend Yearwood is also a host and producer of Climate Friday on WPFW every Friday. The conversation looked at the impact of Hurricane Katrina, which devastated New Orleans and surrounding areas in the Gulf of Mexico, which caused the death of nearly 1,400 people and was also the costliest Atlantic hurricane. In the conversation, there's particular attention on the disproportional negative impact of climate change on people of the African world, climate justice, environmental destruction by multinational corporations, and the role of a Pan-Africanist environmental movement. On Friday, August 29, from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m., WPFW will present From the Ninth Ward to the Airwaves, commemorating the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. The show is produced by Hip Hop Caucus in partnership with WPFW. The music in the background is Now Is the Time by Charlie Parker, and we play that commemorating his birthday, which is August 29. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Mwiza Muntali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shanana with Zain Al-Amin, which looks at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East, particularly looking at the plight of Palestinians. And that's followed by the women's collective Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by the Browder File with Tony Browder. And that's followed by Sojourner Truth with Nana Jamfi. And that's followed by Kombit Lakai with Eugenia Charles. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers Michael Nicella and Clea Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers Chanda Kozer and Funan Gonda, and our Africa World Now Project Collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Erdison. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Reality Poem by Linton Kwesi Johnson, commemorating his birthday, which is August 24th. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe.
This is the age of reality, but somehow we are dealing with mythology. This is the age of science and technology, but somehow we are check for antiquity. When we can't face reality, we let go with clarity.
Nous sommes la chante vanité. Nous sommes cool, insanité. Nous sommes get vision. We start preach religion. But them can't make decision when it come to a fight. Them can't make decision when it come to the rights. Man, this is the age of reality. But somehow we a deal with mythology. This is the age of science and technology. But somehow we a check for antiquity. Them when they gone out of line, they not living for a time. For them say them get sign and them blind. Them eye to the light of the world. I'm gonna search within the dark of them doom. And I shout about sin instead of fight to win. Man, this is the age of reality. But somehow we a deal with mythology. This is the age of science and technology. But somehow we a check fee and ticket.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. In a breaking news story, there are multiple victims from a shooting that took place at the Annunciation Catholic School in Minneapolis this morning. Two children have been reported killed and 17 other people injured after a gunman opened fire on school children who were attending Mass. The full extent of the injuries is not yet clear. Children's Minnesota, a local hospital system, said it was treating seven children. Minneapolis police said the attacker died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Authorities believe he was in his early 20s, did not have an extensive criminal history, and acted alone. The police did not release his name or say if he had a connection to the church. He was believed to have used three weapons, a rifle, a shotgun, and a pistol. Police are still searching for a motive. In other news, President Trump recently reinstated an additional process to the process of becoming a U.S. citizen. WPFW's Noah Portner has more.
Just yesterday, the Trump administration announced that it is activating a decades-old process of interviews for prospective U.S. citizens. These so-called neighborhood checks have not been used since the presidency of George H.W. Bush and involve the State Department conducting interviews with neighbors and co-workers. These on-the-ground investigations are allegedly supposed to ensure that new citizens are, quote, well-disposed to the good order and happiness of the United States, end quote. This latest announcement is part of President Trump's pattern of restricting legal immigration, freezing the refugee admissions program, and adding additional barriers for green cards and citizenship. Some experts in the field call these checks a rarely beneficial waste of time, insisting that criminal background checks and the mandated civics test are enough. From WPFW News, I'm Noah Portner.
In more news, the Department of Government Efficiency may have put Americans' personal information at risk. According to a whistleblower complaint filed by the chief data officer at the Social Security Administration, a former senior DOGE officer, now at Social Security, created a live copy of Social Security records for more than 300 million Americans and uploaded the data in a cloud environment that did not have independent security controls that would allow the host to see who was accessing the data and how they were using it. According to the complaint, the copy of the database contained people's names, social security numbers, dates of birth, addresses, citizenship status, parents' names, and other personal information, potentially putting an enormous amount of private information at risk to being revealed and possibly used by identity thieves. And after FEMA employees signed a letter on Monday criticizing the Trump administration, Several employees have now been placed on leave. Here again is WPFW's Noah Portner.
Yesterday, over 30 employees at the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, said that they were put on leave for speaking out against the current administration. On Monday, 191 FEMA employees signed an open letter criticizing changes to the agency and warning that FEMA's ability to respond to a major crisis is compromised. FEMA has been in flux since Donald Trump retook the White House.